night, Sweats. We love you. My name's Nathaniel Ratliff, and I am proud to be a Ratliff. I love you guys. I love you guys.
Sorry for the fade on that, but I'm also regretting not a planned a little in advance. I was checking the radar, and this storm seems to have popped up in front of the front, according to the radar, just before it broke out. Let's see, 5 minutes in, maybe I'll have to not play Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentary here. That's a shame. He has a 10-piece, not a topical item like he usually does. He's just co-authored a book called Murder Incorporated. I'm sure that bugs a lot of people. It's about U.S. foreign policy. He has a long piece about Jefferson and Monticello and the Panopticon, and it's really, really pretty intriguing. So maybe I should play them both back-to-back sometime. This is only part one. He promises another, the paradox of liberty, he calls it. So while I'm belatedly queuing this stuff up to play, I will perhaps go off. Isn't it a coinkydink that this FBI, not directly from Mueller, indictments come just as the POTUS is going to meet Putin, and now the Cold War liberals are calling for the cancellation of it. I have trepidation about it as well, but I think jaw is better than war, as they say, even if we have the unlikely jaw of Donald Trump with all of his entanglements with Russia, which the ones that I'm thinking about always are the ones that predate his political ambitions, though maybe that's not for me to say, but when the flood of money from the Yeltsin-Clinton corruption era came out of Russia, there's more Russian quote-unquote capital offshore than there is in the country, I've heard from my good friends at taxjustice.net. I believe them. That there was a lot of hot and dirty money that needed to be laundered, and indeed, Trump and his sort were happy to do it. He perhaps more enthusiastically. If you look up Felix Sater and look at why he there should have been allegations against Trump much earlier, the co-developer of Trump Soho went state's evidence but didn't testify against Trump. He went after all the usual suspects, rather. So I'm pretty skeptical of the timing and the whole matter. And I've been skeptical for quite a while. I was citing William Binney about the Democratic National Committee files. He says that he can deduce something from something like metadata that the transfer rate that the file was assembled at. I don't know how they do these things, but he was career veteran, 30 years in the CIA. He developed Thin Threads, which was too cheap for the likes of the SAIC, which is a sort of a local corporation. If any corporation is local, it was founded here. Scientific Applications in International Computing, it's called euphemistically. Special agent in charge, and it even spells CIA's backwards. They wanted to spend a lot of money making a system that looked at everything, as opposed to Thin Threads was to optimize most likely communications of people that they thought needed to be watched, which might have been broader than I would have liked, but at least it was not collect everything, as it has said. One of the places I'm going to is Flashpoints with Kevin Pena sitting in, and he interviews a guy from Electronic Frontier Foundation. Something I'd heard nowhere else is that the NSA is, we've heard about Facebook purging bots, but apparently the NSA is going to dump a lot of files, and EFF is curious if that's more of a cover-up than a compliance with the new law. It's a pretty complicated story, but it's chronicled on the edition of Flashpoints from Tuesday last week, which is where he gets a hold of a guy from Arizona to talk about NATO. So I have two NATO-related interviews from Pacifica outside the Rolodex of the American media. They'd rather go to Victoria Nuland at blank the EU, former ambassador to the NATO and to Ukraine. We invested $8 billion in getting Ukraine, something to that effect. You can find her, N-U-L-A-N-D, if you want to follow any of that down. So I think I'll probably hear the last bit of Mumi Abu-Jamal. I commend this essay to your attention. Like I say, it goes into the architecture of Monticello and the Panopticon, and how I used to sit up at the top of the thing and look at all of his house and grounds and his slaves and make notes on what was going on. It's pretty pretty sad story, actually. So Upfront and Flashpoints. I've got Amy Goodman, since I'm eliding this Mumia Abu-Jamal commentary, most of it. I commend it all to your attention. I've got some built-in intros. I hope they work out all right. And hope our tower isn't getting too much wind shear tonight, today. Looks like night right now. All right, thanks for tuning in, and do help support WEFT. Oh yeah, the other thing is that there's pretty intriguing behind the news following me today with Doug Henwood. He has a short interview with a British guy who's been tracking the, I don't know what to call them. I don't call them militia movements. They are more ideological than just wanting to have their guns. The people that were pardoned by Trump this week has the backstory. He also talks about Portland in terms of it being more vicious, not quite as much going on as in Charlottesville, but he was actually on the ground at Charlottesville. So if you want to hear about our proto-brown shirts, you might want to check that out. The Proud Boys providing security for the demo. Portland last week. There's supposed to be another one in hot August up that way, too. So here's a just probably a little couple of seconds of Mumia. Wish I could have gotten over here on time and played this as I intended. From Mumia Abu-Jamal's book that recently was co-authored with another scholar. Amy Goodman has an obvious analogy, it seems to me, but I haven't actually heard it anywhere else, so I guess it takes a genius to point out the obvious about the Thai soccer players and their rescue and how others haven't been rescued. The South Sudan comes to my mind after watching Nikki Haley call for an arms embargo into Sudan. Maybe it's just South Sudan. After decades of destabilizing and militarizing the area, including the use of early use of Blackwater, maybe before they even were called Blackwater, to arm Christian soldiers and train them, establish a new state in Africa. Hypocrisy there is palpable, I hope, for you. I'm also responding topically to NATO issues this week. The Skripal poisoning, which has now been complicated by the fact that one of the people that died from it actually had a vial of, or a bottle of Novichok, whatever it was, in her household. So, apparently these two were certified heroin users in Britain, which maintained them. My question is anybody doing the investigation to see if they were paid to use the material and finally succumb to it themselves? And then there's the latest indictment by the FBI from the Mueller investigations, they say. A quinkadink, really coincidental issuing of this. Reminds me of Madea Benjamin's line, which I espouse entirely. It's important to love peace more than you hate Trump. And that doesn't mean you have to hate Trump any less. So NATO issues will be discussed from a different lens through Pacifica Kanhalanen and a scholar at University of Arizona. Had his name right in front of me. Maybe I'll reprise it at some point. University of Arizona, where Noam Chomsky is now. It seems like this might not be an accident. This professor of history and government has written a major book on the Balkan intervention, causing him to be attacked from many different directions. All right, I already said Amy Goodman's on her way, and here she is.
In Thailand, the kids are all right. Elsewhere, not so much. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. In Thailand, the saga of 12 young soccer players and their coach, trapped deep inside the inundated Tham Luang cave complex, gripped the world. Their successful rescue was a cause for global celebration. Juxtapose this outpouring of compassion and solidarity with the catastrophe facing millions of children in Yemen and the ongoing debacle created here in the United States by President Donald Trump with the forced separation of migrant children from their parents. These comparisons do not make America look great.
Allahu Akbar!
Since 2015, Yemen has been subjected to unrelenting airstrikes by Saudi Arabia, with critical support and arms from the United States, slaughtering the civilian population. The recent siege of the port city of Hodeidah has forced at least 121,000 civilians to flee. Shireen Al-Adimi, a Yemeni scholar and activist based in the United States, told the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
any kind of disruption to the aid that's coming in through the port of Hodeidah means the starvation of millions of Yemenis. 8.4 million, like you said, are on the verge of starvation. And another, 22 million people, 80% of the population, are relying on humanitarian aid that is coming in through this port of Hodeidah.
Since the war in Yemen began, according to UNICEF, more than half of Yemen's health facilities have closed or been destroyed. 1,500 schools have been damaged by airstrikes and shelling. At least 2,200 children have been killed, 3,400 injured. UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said last week in Geneva after returning from a trip to Yemen, quote, "These are only numbers we've been able to verify. The actual figures could be even higher. There's no justification," she said, "for this carnage." At least 1 million children are suffering from severe malnutrition in Yemen, the poorest country in the Middle East, heightening susceptibility to the world's largest cholera epidemic that has swept the nation, infecting over 1 million Yemenis. Images of these skeletal children, in some cases just hours before death, are devastating. Meanwhile, in the United States, over 3,000 children remain separated from their parents in the wake of Trump's disastrous zero-tolerance policy. A federal judge ordered the Trump administration to reunite these children with their parents or other family members. This is Secretary of Health and Human Services Alex Azar testifying in Congress.
There is no reason why any parent would not know where their child is located. I could, at keystrokes, I sat on the ORR portal with just basic keystrokes within seconds, could find any child in our care for any parent.
And yet, the Trump administration missed the first deadline, July 10th, to reunite all 102 children under the age of 5 with their parents, which doesn't bode well for releasing all 3,000 children by the judge's deadline of July 26th. As that first deadline loomed, Secretary Azar attempted to describe their failure to reunite the children as a success, speaking on CNN.
It is one of the great acts of American generosity and charity what we are doing for these unaccompanied kids who are smuggled into our country or come across illegally.
Parroting his boss Donald Trump's infamous 2015 campaign launch speech, in which Trump denigrated Mexicans as rapists and murderers, Azar spoke on CNN about some of the parents.
We could put children back with individuals who are murderers, kidnappers, rapists, or are not their parents, but we've worked with the court to ensure that we do our duty, which is to protect child welfare and ensure that they are in fact that.
In fact, many of these people fled to the United States from Central America to avoid just such violence. The self-proclaimed law and order president violates the law, which guarantees a hearing to those seeking asylum. On Monday, the UN Security Council met to debate a resolution on children in armed conflict. It passed unanimously. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, born Nimrata Randhawa, the daughter of Indian immigrants, said,
"The Security Council must hold governments accountable for how they treat children both during and after active conflicts. They cannot neglect the unseen damage done to children's hearts and minds."
If Ambassador Haley and the Trump administration care about children's hearts and minds, they could show it by immediately reuniting the thousands of children they've taken from their parents and ensure those families receive due process. They also should stop backing the Saudi-led bombing of Yemen, which is killing thousands of children. The New York Times reports several of the young soccer players and their coach rescued in Thailand are stateless refugees, having fled violence and persecution in neighboring Burma. Let the migrant children locked up by President Trump here in the United States and the children of Yemen feel a similar outpouring of kindness, an equal global effort to deliver them to safety. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
That was amazingly potent, it seems to me. I have to admit that I had a glimmer of that idea of making the comparison broader than just the benighted in Yemen, though that's a very salient example since the U.S. is such a benefactor of the alliance that's, part of the alliance that's shelling and bombing, strafing in Sana'a and Yemen more thoroughly. All right, I mentioned I was going to not cover the Skripal poisoning stuff. I commend your attention to Craig Murray on that issue. He's written another piece, which I haven't written yet, that collects some of his earlier critiques, the early one called Rushing to Conclusions. He's also penned something just recently about NATO that I found quite fascinating. He says that the Libya attack, which went beyond the UN guidelines, by the way, became a full assault, has obviously destabilized the NATO allies. Particularly the southern ones are taking the brunt of people coming across the Mediterranean. The other issue, William Binney of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity group, he resigned the NSA when he saw that the surveillance was going to go way beyond what he thought was constitutionally authorized. There's a movie about him called A Good American, I guess. And there's another documentary where he's featured. He's been consorting with Ray McGovern and sorts. He has the thesis that from the files that he saw, which came from, I think, both the leaked files from the DNC, but there's something like a metadata that includes the rate of transfer that the file was transferred at, to be redundant, and that it surpasses what the internet could have provided, so that he thinks that's pretty good evidence, and given the circumstances of the animosity inside the Democratic National Committee and the party over Sanders being finessed out, or worse, that it's likely it was a leak and not a hack. This doesn't say that the Russians weren't involved in mucking about in a variety of ways, but does undercut the main thesis of the indictment, it seems to me. So I think he has a piece at Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and I think he has his own website too. He's, as I mentioned, quit the NSA over their excesses some time ago. But let's now go to Upfront with two great hosts, Brian Edwards Tiekert. They'll introduce himself. Juhasz has been with Oil Change International, is a great journalist on, in her own right, and is now hosting this two-hour morning show called Upfront, which promises to do more about the Helsinki encounter, if you will, next week. So another piece from Pacifica after that. And that'll be Kevin Pena with a scholar from the University of Arizona, who I still haven't named yet. So here's Upfront.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert.
And I'm Antonia Juhasz.
And Donald Trump is wrapping up his European grand tour after multiple days of talks with NATO. He has managed to talk in one direction, walk in another. On the opening day of talks, he called Germany a captive of Russia, referring obliquely to their natural gas purchases. He called on the allies inside the North Atlantic Treaty Organization to double their military spending to 4% of gross domestic product, which is, by the way, more than the United States spends. And in a parting shot, responding to a question from reporters as he boarded his airplane, redeclared himself a very stable genius. Rhetoric notwithstanding, he signed on to a very standard declaration at the end of the summit, which called on the powers within NATO to hit their pre-existing target of increasing their military spending to 2% of GDP by the year 2020, and to increase their military readiness to the point where they could deploy 30 battalions, 30 air squadrons, and 30 warships within 30 days. Here is a quick cut of what Donald Trump sounded like coming out of that summit.
NATO is much stronger now than it was 2 days ago. I think that NATO was not doing what they were supposed to be doing, a lot of the countries, and we were doing much more than we should have been doing. Frankly, we were carrying too much of a burden. That's why we call it burden sharing. I was using the term a lot today, burden sharing. We had a fantastic meeting at the end, 29 countries, and they are putting up a lot.
Again, our president in Europe at the close of the NATO summit. Joining us to talk about what the rhetoric means and what the actual developments mean is Con Hallinan. He's a columnist with Foreign Policy and Focus, someone who understands military hardware better than just about anyone else on the left. Thank you for coming in, sir.
Thanks for having me here.
What's Donald Trump doing differently?
Nothing really. I mean, this is part of his sound and fury style of politics. It's sort of international politics as a variety of the bachelorette of reality TV. He comes in, he says, he's talking to his base, he says, you guys aren't paying the bills, you have to pay more of the bills, and that plays well among his base. You know, these foreigners are taking advantage of us and that kind of thing. But, you know, in the end, they signs the agreement that everybody else signed on to. Certainly, the United States is not going to withdraw from NATO. NATO is incredibly important for the United States. People forget that the war in Afghanistan is not a U.S. war, that's a NATO war. And NATO gives an enormous amount of cover to what is now going on 18 years of war, and a war which, by the way, is also pretty clear violation of international law. So NATO is an enormous asset to the United States, and that, you know, he's not going to withdraw from them, but he's going to make as much political hay out of it as he can.
The other political signaling he seemed to be doing was about the U.S. as arms dealer. He talked to the press corps about how great our hardware is and how he's looking forward to selling more of it to the Europeans.
Yeah, really. He was like a used car salesman. He really was. He wants them to up it to 4%, which, as you pointed out, Brian, is larger than we spend. I think we spend between 3.8 and 3.9% of our gross domestic product on weapons. Although that's a bit of a misnomer, because a lot of what we spend on military things gets hidden. For instance, that doesn't include nuclear weapons, because nuclear weapons are under the Energy Department. So there are all sorts of little ways that we do things like that. And given that the focus is on Russia, that's what the statement was really aimed at, then this is sort of big nation competition, which is what the Trump administration came in saying, that they were switching from the war against terrorism to the war to great nation competition, particularly China and Russia. Well, those are big ticket weapons. Those are fancy airplanes. They are big ships. They are fancy tanks. They're expensive, and gee, the Americans makes them. So, even though we don't do what we do just because of the arms company, you know, Boeing and General Atomics and Lockheed Martin all have a seat at the table, and that was very much. And you can see them waving their hands in the back, saying, "Yeah, we got all those things. We can provide them."
Well, you've talked about signaling towards the American electorate and towards American arms manufacturers. Do you see any signaling towards Vladimir Putin and Russia going into their summit with Donald Trump next week?
I don't think so. I think the Russians probably look at this and are probably as cynical as I am about it. You know, I think the problem with what we're seeing here is that the American media is not really doing the story, which is to really examine what is NATO. And should NATO really exist? Now, the idea was, when NATO was originally set up, there was an old slogan. NATO was formed to keep the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. That was the sort of slogan of NATO. It was formed in 1949. The Warsaw Pact was not formed until 1955.
Warsaw Pact was the military alliance.
Was the military alliance of the Soviet Union. And after the Soviet Union fell, when people got a chance to go into the archives of the Russian military, they found that the Russians never had a plan to invade Western Europe. The Russians were not stupid. I mean, they knew that any invasion of Western Europe would be a nuclear war, and that would immediately get out of hand. So this whole idea of the aggressive Russians, the revanchist Russians, Obama said that the Russia was attempting to recover lost glory through force, kind of stuff. The Russian bugaboo. That has been the kind of impetus to spreading, to increasing military spending. But if you look at the record, what you find is that you take a look at a record, a map of Europe in 1988, and you look at it today, it's quite obvious who's going in what direction. In 1990, U.S. Secretary of State James Baker and German Chancellor Helmut Kohl and Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev sat down. They came to an agreement that the Soviets would withdraw all military forces from Eastern Europe on the condition that NATO not move east of Germany. That was the agreement. Well, today, virtually all members of the Warsaw Pact are members of NATO. NATO is carrying out military maneuvers on the Russian border. The Obama administration put anti-ballistic missile bases in Eastern Europe, supposedly aimed at Iran. Iran doesn't even have any rockets, let alone nuclear weapons, to reach Western Europe. So from the point of view of the Russians, they see NATO moving eastward. And I think the key moment in that was the Serbian War in 1999. And after that, the Russians decided that NATO was coming for them. And they started, pulling the wagons in a circle. And it's been that way ever since.
Speaking of Con Hallinan, he's a military analyst and a columnist for Foreign Policy in Focus. What do you make of the specific jab at Germany, in which Donald Trump called Germany a quote-unquote captive of Russia?
because Donald Trump wants the Germans to use American oil and American gas and that comes from fracking. That's what this is all about. The Nord 2 line, which is a new, I think it's $12 billion pipeline that runs from Russia to Germany. It's very important for German industry. It's low-cost gas. It's also environmentally sound. And the Germans, you know, have made a commitment to end all nuclear power plants and to reduce greenhouse gases. So natural gas coming in on the Nord 2 is not only good for German industry, but it also fits into the Germans' approach to what they should be doing environmentally around the Paris Climate Accords. So, of course, you know, he's going to pound on this. It's interesting how he creates these adversaries, you know. First he created North Korea that was Rocket Man. So he goes after the North Koreans. Then he actually went after the South Koreans. Then he goes after he's been going after the Germans for some time. The Germans are doing this, Germans are doing this. He goes after the Canadians. The Canadians are a national security threat. That's his way of doing it. It makes it very simple for his own base. You create these kind of bugaboos and you put them up there and you attack them. And, you know, I think the attack on Germany, from his point of view, it had more to do with the fact of trying to disarm Germany as a critic of American foreign policy. And I think that's the main thing. But there is another element, too. Anywhere that Trump goes, he is surrounded by corporations. And those corporations are constantly whispering into his ear, mother's milk is a bad idea. Take formula. Make them buy big ticket military items. You know, I mean, there's just whispering, you know, it's right in his ear all the time.
It also comes at a time when the government of German Chancellor Angela Merkel is in the weakest position it's been in during her tenure, being destabilized from surprisingly strong challenges from the xenophobic right within Germany. Do you think there's more than just signaling, that there's some power politics there?
Well, I think that one of the things that, if you recall, the American ambassador to Germany very, very explicitly said that he was encouraging parties like Alternative for Germany. And keep in mind, when we're talking about the European right, some of this right is extremely dangerous.
And Alternative for Germany is the next best thing to modern-day Nazis.
Yeah.
Modern-day Nazis would be illegal in Germany.
Sure. The one of the leaders of the Alternative for Germany said that a Holocaust memorial in Berlin was a slap in the face to all Germans. I mean, except the ones they put in ovens, of course. And who has called for, and this is his word, celebrating the exploits of the Wehrmacht, mm-hmm. which was the Nazi army. The People's Party in Austria was formed in the early 1950s, not just by Nazis, by former members of the SS. So these are dangerous people. But I think the problem here is that you do have a crisis in Europe, but in terms of explaining why the right is doing well, I think that what you have to do is to look at the failure of the center and the center left. That for decades, really ever since Maggie Thatcher came into power in 1979 in Britain, the center-left has gone along with many of the politics of neoliberalism. Tony Blair is a perfect example. But essentially, center-left parties in Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, France put in policies that have created enormous economic inequality in Europe. And if you want to understand what the base of the right is in Europe today, it is this growing crisis of economic inequality. And it's not just limited to Europe. Obviously, it exists in the United States. In fact, it's a crisis of global capitalism itself. And, you know, my concern is that to respond to something like the Alternative for Germany or the Front in France or the League in Italy, etc., with, you know, look, we need to have liberal democracy, instead of you have this crisis where young people can't get jobs. When they do get jobs, they're gig jobs. From 2013 to 2016, of the 5.2 million jobs that were created in the European Union, 2.3 million of them were temp jobs that either had no benefits or very low benefits and absolutely no job security whatsoever. So this is where the crisis lies. And the center left, and the center and the left has not been addressing it. And only two places where they have done that, in Portugal and in England, they've they've actually done quite well. They've really made some progress. So I think what you're seeing here is that you really do have a crisis in Europe. You have a crisis in capitalism. And nobody's reporting on that. I mean, the press is so enamored of this bachelorette approach to foreign policy. And then they're sucked in by it, and they can't help themselves. You know, they sort of latch onto it. In the meantime, the real issues and the real problems, which are behind this growth of the right and the crisis in the European Union, those are not being addressed, and they're not being reported upon. And that is, I consider, a scary thing.
So one of the key ways that this crisis is taking shape in Europe is a extreme conflict over the flow of refugees, and this is one of the ways in which Merkel has been weakened in recent weeks. So we're now, so far we've been discussing the NATO summit through the lens of mm-hmm. Donald Trump. So let's turn it around. What was the NATO summit intended to achieve for the Europeans involved, and did it achieve any of those goals?
I don't think it did particularly. And I quite agree with you that the question of the immigration is such a central point now. It's sort of ironic because actually immigration is greatly down
In the United States.
No, in Europe.
There's the lowest,
lowest number of refugees since 2012 in Europe. The other thing that's interesting about it, and again, it's this thing of, you know, sort of, you know, not talking about the elephant in the living room. Europe has a crisis, and the crisis is that the birth rates have fallen all over Europe. They average in the EU about 1.58. In order to have a standard replication rate, you have to have 2.1. That's the standard formula for that. The irony is that immigration played the central role in the Italian elections. Italy has the second lowest birth rate in the world. Mm-hmm. Only Japan is lower. It has a 1.39% replacement rate. They lose the equivalent of the population of Bologna every 3 years, about 75,000 people. In 30 years, their pension system will collapse. Their infrastructures will collapse. They will collapse. Germany needs 500,000 immigrants every single year for the next 30 years. Otherwise, their pension and healthcare system will collapse as well. So what you see, and then this, we see this in the United States, we also are below 2.1, but we have had a fairly robust, you know, flow of immigrants in. What's interesting here is that this is a really serious problem, and it's going to cause it's going to exacerbate the crisis that already exists about economic inequality, because the solution to it is to cut pensions, to cut subsidies, to cut education, to cut public transport.
And you're saying that's the solution that voters in European powers are hearing from their center-left parties?
Yes.
And then the right saying the solution is to keep the immigrants out.
That's right.
And nobody's saying, at least nobody with a big toehold in politics, actually we need the immigrants, we need them working, we need their contributions to our safety net if we want to have the programs that you all care about.
Yeah, and they're afraid to do that. I mean, they know that. I mean, they actually know that. The woman in Italy, the woman who was the interior minister and who was a member of the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party was a split from the old Italian Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and she kind of had a little separate party of her own. She's a left person. She was the only person who was out there saying, you're going to kill us all. If we don't bring these immigrants in, you're literally going to kill Italian society. But nobody listened to her, and the left was too afraid to take on that issue. They saw that as a third rail. The result is that we're going to have an absolutely massive crisis in Europe, not caused by immigrants coming in, you know, with different cultures and languages and religions, but by a lack of those. The response of the Democratic Party's labor minister before the election, remember, this is a socialist party, asked what he was going to do about youth unemployment, which is just a crisis in Italy. He said that young people should emigrate and, quote, not get under our feet, unquote. Now, would you vote for that guy? Hmm. Instead, they voted for Pepe Grillo and the Five Star Party, which is very creepy outfit.
Yeah, well, it's like a reality TV mashup of decisions.
It is.
Including some pretty
And by the way, I've gone right along with the Northern League's anti-immigrant stuff.
Wow, Con Hallinan. Good morning to you, too.
They either put people to sleep or really woke them up. Thank you for having me.
What are you going to be watching for with next week's Russia summit?
You know, I think the thing that has to happen, the situation right now with between the United States and Russia and the Western allies. Regardless of what you think of Putin, and I ain't no fan, I don't like the oligarchy. I don't like what I see in Russia. They are not a threat. The Russians are not going to come and get us. But they do have the potential to destroy life, or at least civilization, on the Earth. So what I'd like to see to come out of it is a gradual rollback now of these sanctions, and a normal, logical relationship with the rest of the West. I mean, the British chief of staff, military chief of staff, made a comment recently that said that the relationships with Russia, it feels like the eve of 1914, World War One. This is nuts, and also really dangerous. There are a lot of places that the United States is going to disagree with the Russians, but there are a lot of places they can work together. Syria being the most obvious, Iran being a very obvious area, let alone things like climate accord, etc. But the main thing is reduce the tension in Europe. Stop maneuvering troops on each other's borders. Stop pouring American troops into the Baltic countries, into Poland, etc. Take those ABM launchers out of Europe. That's what I'd like to see come out of it. Do I expect that to come out of it? I live in a dream world sometimes.
Con Hallinan, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Con Hallinan is a columnist with Foreign Policy in Focus. That takes us to 8:30 in the morning. The program's up front. My name's Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas. So much to continue on with that conversation, which we will do in next week when we're going to have shows looking at the summit between Trump and Putin coming up on.
Con Hallinan, I like to hear his voice. He needs to be heard more often. He writes a lot for the Institute for Policy Studies. He's with the Foreign Policy in Focus group. IPS-DC will get you there. FPIP, I believe. Or FPIF, Foreign Policy in Focus. I don't know about his immigrant economics. A reorganization of the economy in Europe and anywhere would summarized by, shallowly characterized by Tax the Robots, would provide something for the welfare of all, promoting the domestic welfare from the preamble. That would obviate the need for the population increase that was mentioned here in the analysis, but that's a bit of an aside. Okay, now to another segment on NATO, and this again is with Arizona University Professor David Gibbs, who has a book out on the Balkans. I'm suggesting that it might not be an accident that that's where Chomsky has taken his twilight years. He's transferred from MIT to Arizona, and he has the book Lessons from Kosovo. That's quite great on the Balkans, written more contemporaneously than this retrospective that's about 8 years old now from Gibbs. So without further ado, this is Kevin Pina filling in for Dennis Bernstein on holiday. What a time to pick a holiday. Expect some product from him next week as well. David Bernstein. Kevin Pina is doing some great work. It's got ties to a lot of Salvadorans and revolutionaries from the day in El Salvador, Central America, more broadly, that he has had interviews with all week. Won't have time for foreshadowing the NSA interview that he did about the imminent destruction of a lot of files. Is it a good thing or is it a cover-up? Somebody from the Internet Freedom Foundation, I guess, IFF, is that right? I'm losing my voice, so I'll turn it over to Kevin Pina and David Gibbs.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, let's turn our attention now to the question of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which we know has a long history, especially since World War II, and has played a distinct role during the Cold War. We now hear President Trump talking about how it is now becoming obsolete, that NATO is no longer, we've heard this argument for quite a while, that NATO's not carrying its fair share of the burden of protecting Europe from the evil Russia, I think, is the main thrust of the argument. Now joining us to talk about that and more is David Gibbs. He's a professor of history at the University of Arizona and author of the 2009 book, First Do No Harm, Humanitarian Intervention and the Destruction of Yugoslavia, published by Vanderbilt University Press. David Gibbs, welcome to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about NATO and its history. What role has NATO played historically? Now, we know in addition to this whole thing about being a bulwark against Soviet expansion during the Cold War, that NATO more recently has been involved in the war in Iraq. It was involved in Libya. And now, of course, we are hearing more about its role during the war to destroy Yugoslavia. Tell us a little bit about that history.
Well, I think that the function of NATO officially, if you look at its charter, had really one official purpose, and that was to defend Europe against a Soviet invasion from 1949 to 1989. With the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989, that ended, essentially that role ended, with the Cold War ending. And there really was no obvious function for NATO. In the early 90s, there was much discussion about the possibility of NATO simply dying away as something that no longer has a function. I think what you had was a series of vested interests in the U.S., and to some extent in Western Europe, that really did not want NATO to go away for reasons having nothing to do with security. And so NATO was preserved, I think. The uniformed militaries on both sides of the Atlantic liked NATO, and military producers liked it as well. But it didn't really have any function.
When you say military producers, you mean like arms manufacturers?
Arms manufacturers, yes. And it didn't have any legitimate function in terms of there was no enemy to protect against that was threatening Europe. No. Anybody could think of. And so the logical thing to do would simply have been to dissolve NATO as an obsolete organization that was extremely expensive anyway and deserved to go. But as I said, vested interests prevented this. And, you know, there was also the issue that NATO gave the United States a lot of influence in Europe, including non-military activities such as economic policy. American corporations like the Entree that NATO gave them. Again, NATO is officially just a military organization, but it has political and economic implications as well, which were very apparent in the 90s.
Hasn't using the NATO mantle or identifying a military operation as with NATO involvement or being led by NATO somehow gives credibility to U.S. interventions, such as what happened in Yugoslavia?
Well, I think mostly what you had was you had a need to come up with a new function for NATO because it was not sufficient to say NATO exists because the military likes it or because it contributes to U.S. prestige or weapons manufacturers. It's not a legitimate public claim to make, even if that was the reality. And I think that what you had was an effort to find some new security threat. As I saw it, the 90s was almost a search for enemies by U.S. foreign policy, an effort almost to find new enemies to replace the old enemy. Now, you might say that's a very dysfunctional thing to do, because really, what reasonable person would want enemies and security threats? But nevertheless, I think that was the attitude. It was openly expressed. President Clinton once said, half-jokingly, that I missed the Cold War. And I only think that was half-joking. He half-meant it as well, and many people said similar things. So there was a need to find new enemies and new functions. And the first function, I would say, was humanitarian intervention, that NATO would now play a new humanitarian role. And Yugoslavia was the main arena for establishing that. In my view, and again, I've written a book on this, NATO really made the Yugoslav war much worse. It helped to scuttle a series of peace plans that might have settled the war much earlier and with fewer deaths and casualties. But I think the objective here was to find some new military function for NATO that would justify its existence. And the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina in 95 and then the war in Kosovo in 99 were critical in relegitimating NATO. And I think that after that, the function began to be expansion of NATO into the former communist bloc of Eastern Europe, and then after that into the former Soviet Union. And now this was a very touchy issue, and the reason it was a touchy issue is the United States had agreed in 1990 not to expand NATO into the East. This was a public agreement with the Soviet Union as a part of a deal to elicit Soviet support for reunification of Germany. And, you know, the Soviets only agreed to accept a reunified Germany if NATO would not expand, and the U.S. agreed to that. But the U.S. promptly began to violate that agreement. I would say that the current conflict with Russia is mostly a product of the U.S. decision to violate the 1990 agreement. And so NATO has generated a lot of insecurity. I would say that, for example, the wars in Georgia in 2008 and in the continuing war that began in Ukraine in 2014 were more than anything else the product of efforts to bring those two countries into NATO and Russian insistence that that would be a threat to their security. And so, you know, NATO here has been mostly a destabilizing insecurity-generating machine, as it were, that really doesn't really serve any positive function, but certainly serves a very negative function.
And let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that's the voice of our guest, David Gibbs. He's a professor of history at the University of Arizona. He wrote a book entitled First Do No Harm, Humanitarian Intervention and the Destruction of Yugoslavia, published by Vanderbilt University Press. We're discussing NATO and what function it serves. Now, of course, there have been more contemporary roles that NATO has played in countries like Libya. We know that they were involved in Iraq. We know that there's been some NATO involvement in Afghanistan. Let's talk about the more contemporaneous role that NATO has been playing.
Well, apart from basically triggering contention with Russia, I think the second most important NATO function was essentially to destabilize Libya. The 2011 NATO intervention in Libya, led by Britain and France, but supported very strongly by the United States, that was a NATO operation. And, you know, it was presented with the promise that it would create a more democratic and more humane Libya. Obviously, it had the opposite effect. It profoundly destabilized Libya, made the people of Libya even worse off than they were under Gaddafi. And Gaddafi was not a nice leader, but what happened afterwards was indeed worse, which is permanent destabilization of the country. In addition, the leaking out of weapons and fighters from Libya into the region has destabilized much of North Africa. For example, the civil wars in Mali and to some extent Niger were influenced considerably by the breakdown of security within Libya. So you have a kind of regionalized destabilization and also a source of terrorism, I should add. It's created something of an interventionist treadmill in the sense that, you know, there's been ongoing U.S. and European NATO intervention in Libya that is justified by the need to sort of clean up the mess that NATO created in the first place with its intervention in 2011. The famous political scientist Chalmers Johnson once claimed that, you know, the entire U.S. Foreign policy since the end of the Cold War has served basically to generate insecurity for the United States. If the U.S. intervenes in a country, it destabilizes the country, producing destabilizing effects that damage U.S. security, requiring more and more intervention. NATO has served this function as well, and Libya is a very dramatic case of this.
Of course, President Trump has been talking about how NATO is costing us too much. It sounds as if he'd be okay with the role, the military role, that NATO plays, as long as more of the cost was borne by its member states.
Well, let me start off by saying that I think Trump is I agree with the general perception that Trump is a very reckless and dangerous figure to occupy the White House, and in no way am I, you know, speaking positively about the presidency here. But, now on specific points, he makes legitimate points, and on NATO he does as well. I think narrowly conceived, what he's saying is that the Europeans need to pay a larger share of the financial cost of NATO. But I think he's doing something else, too. He's doing, first of all, he's raising the issue that NATO is not essential for the United States. Until now, I think the general perception was that NATO, the U.S. would never leave NATO under any circumstances, that NATO is such a vital security interest that it's not something that can be questioned, and Trump is questioning the value of NATO, and I think he's right to do so. Secondly, he's raising the issue that NATO is very expensive, and the cost of keeping NATO in existence is borne, in part at least, by the U.S. public. That it is, yes, coming out of the pockets of the U.S. public and lowering their living standards. And that, in my view, is a legitimate question to raise. Is it worth it financially to spend that much money on something that's generating insecurity? And I think there's a tendency of political liberals and foreign policy specialists to dismiss these points merely because they come from Donald Trump. But I think that kind of knee-jerk reaction isn't the correct response. In this case, I think Trump is actually making some legitimate points.
Well, I think it also raises the question, why wouldn't the Democrats raise that same question? What is it about NATO and the way that U.S. foreign policy has used it abroad as the tip of the sword in some cases, or at least the tip of the sword of propaganda for legitimacy? Why is it that the Democrats haven't raised those same questions?
Well, you know, historically speaking, you know, the left has traditionally been anti-militarist and anti-interventionist. This was a very strong position taken in the 60s, 70s, into the 80s. But for some reason, and I think this is something I don't fully understand, the peace movement died after 1990. And you know, even Bernie Sanders, who obviously had a campaign that many, including myself, considered pathbreaking in many respects, he did not really raise the larger issue of interventionism in the military budget to any significant degree. And I think it's symptomatic of a larger issue on the political left, which is the absence of a real peace movement. And quite strikingly, I should add, that we have seen a peace movement, and I find this a bit perplexing, is on the right. The libertarian right has been raising many of the issues that the left used to raise about you know, the dangerous aspects of U.S. interventionism, the high cost of interventionism financially. And I think it's about time that the left started looking into this matter as well.
Well, very interesting point to leave it on. Again, that's David Gibbs. He's a professor of history at the University of Arizona and author of the 2009 book, First Do No Harm, Humanitarian Intervention and the Destruction of Yugoslavia. We've been talking about NATO and the implications of NATO either carrying its own weight or NATO going away, which doesn't seem likely. But we've been discussing that issue in some detail. David Gibbs, thank you so much for joining us today here on Flashpoints.
Thank you very much.
And it's that time again for another break. When we get back, we're going to be talking about, the National Security Agency and what it's been up to, the boys and girls who are protecting us by invading our privacy. Stay tuned for that and more here on Flashpoints.
Okay, that was Kevin Pena. We aren't going to hear that segment. I commend it to your attention. Apparently, the new laws governing the use of our data, Meta and otherwise, is going to be destroyed. Some backups, and the Electronic Foundation is ambivalent about it a little bit because they have an ongoing lawsuit looking at what was done before. That was from the Tuesday Flashpoints, if you want to look at it, for at flashpoints.net. Before that, we heard from Upfront, Con Hollinan with the... he's on the West Coast. I think he's at Santa Cruz, but he... I have to stop doing that. Works with the D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies with the Foreign Policy in Focus. He hasn't written anything that I could find recently about NATO, but he's obviously got some longstanding opinions about its utility otherwise. Yeah, I guess I have a couple of moments here. The Behind the News is about 52 minutes long. I'm sure Gene will find some great announcements to run by you. I actually haven't done that yet. It's possible that the Street Fest, which was ill-fated last time they tried to do one in downtown Champaign, might go ahead since the storm front seems to have moved in earlier than expected, though maybe there's another one lurking out there. I haven't checked the radar in a while. So I commend that to your attention. The program coming up that I guess I just meant, well, let's see, the Street Fest, Kayla Brown, I saw her recently. She's back to focusing on music. Craig Russo in the Latin jazz, in his Latin jazz group. It just says Craig Russo, like you're supposed to know. Maybe you do, but that's what he does with players all over East Central Illinois, including Chip McNeil on sax. Maybe they have one of the many accordion vibraphone players, and so they can do some Cal Jader tunes. That would be neat. And then the closer from 10:30 to midnight, if things go as scheduled. Tribute to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, a band called Mojo. They've been doing that around town for a while, so they probably have taken requests. There's a community forum at the IMC tomorrow. Abolish ICE, ISO, Champaign-Urbana. Turn anger into action. Solidarity melts ice. That's a good one. I like that. That's 1:30 to 5, so I assume that'll be a panel discussion with a number of different folks. Probably ICE hasn't been invited, but they do enough publicity, and the POTUS certainly talks about them in glowing terms. They're tough. They're tough. They got to be tough. Those kids, you know. And I think that's about all I'll ramble on about right now. The computer clock says 10:59. You know, while I'm not thinking out loud, not thinking at all, I do need to put on an announcement here. That's right. I may have to read one from the Urbana Park District, since that's been coming up on my spot. Yeah, read. So do we have another one from the Park District? Oh, let's see. Urbana Park District, not the Champaign Park District. They're doing some music. They've got that Folk and Roots Fridays. I don't know who played yesterday. I was oblivious. Should have checked that out. Urbana Park District offers aged 50 and up the chance to meet for fun and educational programs. Maybe you qualify. Maybe you dyed your hair white like the pop artist did. The Urbana Park District Senior Club meets monthly at Phillips Recreation Center. People can eat lunch followed by a program. It doesn't say what the lunch is or how that is arranged, but I guess you could find out by calling them at